Blog Talk Radio.
Interesting that in the course of our own existence, we stumble across something as interesting and provocative as Freemasonry. All the declarations, ancient and accepted. Well, we have to understand what that is, but why? If we're curious, we need to know. And the history, well, we unleash some of our finest historians, and you know, that's that constant process of sifting through the past history and starting to make connections, and we get a clearer and clearer picture, and we find, oh my goodness, some of this material is fabricated. Then we have to look for, what would you say, nobler purpose? Why would anybody do that, let alone an organized group of thinkers? Well, there is purpose behind it. And I don't say that just to be generous. It's like the same kind of purpose that I declare when I'm thinking about around the Old Testament or New Testament or the writings of Hindi scripture. You know, there's a relevance and a sacredness because a lot of people are dependent on the developing a sense of loyalty, a sense of connection and purpose. They cannot be interrupted by human frailty. That's belief, what you believe in. So we often, seem to have challenged the Greeks. They went about their business creating the gods that had human frailty. They drank too much. They womanized. They were scoundrels. They were deceptors. And the Greeks know obviously a great deal. But we, the hybrids of our faiths, you know, if I can put it that way, didn't have the vast libraries and access that we did today, but they did have the ideas. Serious thinkers amongst them carried those ideas forward and discussed them with other serious-minded people. They weren't blathering about them in the street. Although at the time there were, you know, there was a messianic kind of energy going on, but and that still is with us if we look seriously for it. But that wasn't enough. There was more. This refinement, the faith that I've been raised in, and I say that hesitantly now because thanks to Freemasonry, I've had an opportunity to re-examine and understand much more about what I believe in. Thank you. We refined, we borrowed, you know, so-called, we created paganism, you know, and then we borrowed from it, capturing all the major holidays and, you know, celebrations. Man, dude, like, we love the solstice, you know? It's just so impactful. The sunshine, whether we're looking at and listening to the ancient Egyptians, our Arabs, Islam, Christian, Jew. There is this almost, it is mystical in a way, magical, truthful. Truthful to come along is sort of the pocketbook version of that, if you could. That material that's full of reference, but so much information is packed into these. It's like the now bear with me, don't be laughing too hard. It's like the entire embodiment, the zeitgeist of Freemasonry is like a mnemonic. The whole, which part you might say, well, I'm afraid all of it. Each piece, it's like playing chess. One move triggers the thinking and you see patterns and it goes on, doesn't it? And then you look and you see the with clarity the thing of your opposition, whether it's an opponent or a mindset, a different way of approaching the patterns. And the worth of it is the excitement, is the strategy. How can I lead you to move in a way that's going to be moves ahead and I can anticipate, and while you're doing the same thing, who's the most clever? Masonry does that. It's not a trick. It's an imperative. But my goodness, it's packaged and put there in a way that would be irrelevant to some. And if you're hungry or worried about your children being sick and dehydrated, the ideas of Freemasonry are not as necessary. You park them. Get on with the seriousness of life in front of you, the need to survive and to preserve and protect the people that you care about. Right now, where I am, the face of the earth, we're re-examining our history, and it's serious, and it's painful. There's an agony. Oh, there's a repulsion. We're re-examining our core beliefs, and that starkness of looking in the mirror and asking, what in the hell have we been doing? I don't know. I don't know if everybody in life has that moment where they look in the mirror and ask that. I hope not, because it's anguish. Because when you ask the question, you already know the answer. But I don't walk around the streets oozing this kind of attitude, do you? Hardly. Maybe we get into the conversation when we're sitting next to each other and we're strangers in the bar and I'm done with my meal at the table and you look across and you're sitting there with your son. You've just flown in from Belgium, whoever you were. And you see that I've finished my meal and I'm ready for a coffee and maybe a brandy or port, and you send over you have the waiter bring over a glass of grappa. And of course it starts a conversation and a greeting. Those chance encounters where there's the safety of anonymity to talk, and when you find somebody else like-minded, it's like there's no self-consciousness. You remember, you encourage one another. If we could only bottle that up. And if we could only create some reason for us to meet. Now that chance encounter, that's like rolling the dice. How many times in a lifetime do you walk into that tiny restaurant or bar and find somebody sitting there that is compatible in a way. And let's try and stack the odds so it happens quite frequently. So I get it. Let's figure out how to create an organization so that men will go there for that specific reason, because they'll know that they'll find like-minded and they can have a serious conversation. But the mnemonics, it'll be there. We can explore, not in lockstep. This isn't my goodness, no. Remember, this is a literate group of people. And don't be so foolish to immediately put up roadblocks to your own ability. You do that, that's on you. Let's free that up. We just create a reference that speaks to universality. Who's able to this? Would I not accept a chess master because of the humility of his or her roots? Oh, would I do it? Would I reject them because they aren't a boy or they are a girl or she is a woman of color? Is that the level of my thinking? Not even close. Let's open the door. Let's kick the shutters open on that. And if you can do it over where you are, what's to say that he can't do it over where he is? How would we do it? Well, we do it the way we've always done it. We talk. The good ideas, sound ideas, ideas that are very viable, they resonate. They don't need public relations. They don't need a sale, a hard sell. They exist because they make sense. They offer a geometry that helps in some way to move things ahead, to make things better. Oh, I guess an answer comes from, swings around to answer my own question about whether Freemasonry is about a duality. In that sense, yes, it is. Everything is not the same. Some things are better and some things are worse. There is some politics is not merit. Merit is not politics. And clarity. That's what makes it worth striving for. Something better. Not just floating around in the soup with an aimless mindset. No. We have direction. And then we have stupidity. Yeah. The people with ability that waste it. That's the definition of stupidity here for Masonic effects. It's not people that are born with whatever they have. God bless them, really. It's people that have the ability and waste it. Frederick, just waste it. Is everybody going to be a dervish or a Sufi? No. But can everybody be appreciative of that? Yeah. It's like the calming effect of somebody that has a devout. Do you see the harmony, that symmetry when you watch a person performing Tai Chi? Do you know? And when you sit with the master and he teaches you about the spirituality of the actions. Ah. And the words that come to your mind when that's happening, that's Freemasonry. You know, that gracefulness. The refinement. So, it's like years ago, my background is, I don't know if you call farm background, working class. I don't know. I think you have to work up to be working class when you're a farmer. everybody thinks you're a bit daft, you know. You don't know anything but dirt. Surprise, you know, I have to know a hell of a lot more than that. Yeah, I might have an upper middle class education or upper class education. Yeah, okay. But you don't get that. You don't walk around pretending that. That's when you have the confidence just to be who you are. When the weirdness isn't so weird anymore, that thing that fascinates you is completely self-satisfied and is mercilessly addictive. You know, is it reading? Well, you're listening to a fellow that has an endless chess game on the go. I'm not that good, but I have to have the board out. And I have to make the move. It's just endless. And it's obvious. It's because it's strategic. It's just this mathematics. And yes, I can sit and watch other people play. I often think that with the little lodges around where I'm at, it would be such a Masonic gesture if they started to sponsor chess tournaments. And me, I would probably be looking at a small token or reward or sponsorship of the best up-and-coming young woman. Yeah, because I live in a place where equality is not what it's claimed to be. That's me. You each have your own. I'd love to sit down. And by the way, we're going to get into the program here. And I think it's your round. I'm just going to go to the men's room for a second. And when I come back, it would be very nice. Thank you very much. I think you're going to enjoy the program today. Emergence. This one's called Emergence. I feel like Cirque du Soleil. You have these terms, and it does. You sit down and put a little bit of thought into it. To these terms that trigger an idea. Mnemonic, yeah. And the music, it's just the music that's right for you right now. Today, wherever you happen to be, whether it's morning or afternoon or evening or late into the night. This is where this compelling aspect of the craft can show itself. No, we invite bureaucrats to come and sit and listen. Yeah, it's okay. Your mom's proud of you. but you're not the front man in this band, boys. No, if you thought that, you know, if you gained that sense of being the Mandarin, well, no, you're still the Mandarin. And you're part, you're an important part. We don't have a stage manager. Whoa, can you imagine the chaos of bringing the symphony forward in the house when the audience is sitting there waiting, haven't paid their ticket? Mm-mm-mm. It's the attention to detail in the background that makes the magic. Well, today we're just going to pull back the curtain just a little bit. And together we're going to take a look and see what we find about ancient and accepted. Well, go with that right now. Ancient, well before 1717. The ideas that we're juggling and we're sampling, much, much older, thousands of years, millennia. Think in millennia. I'm going to kick this show off with sharing a bit of music that I hope will, you know, it's intended to just to accentuate the mood that we enjoy. This is Gene Harris. If you haven't heard his work, check this. Yeah. Thoughts out. That worked, didn't it? What's not to work? By the way, thank you for the round. We do you stumble to find the starting point and if you do, just let us during the program, treat you. Let us carry you along. Sit back. Sip whatever you have at hand that relaxes you. Focus on the ideas that are coming forward. And wait. Be patient for the flow of the connections to appear. They'll be there. They always are. See, particularly the company you keep. So when you walk into that restaurant and you're taking your coat off and handing it to the staff, is that when you decided you're going to have a meaningful conversation with a complete stranger? No, you're looking around at the lighting to see who's in the room. Find a comfortable spot. You're dealing with the maitre d' taking you to your table, settling in and asking you, but very politely, if you would like something while you're Pellegrino and maybe some wine. You know? This commentary today is entitled Emergence. And the idea was looking at the moves. And each one emerges. And we can say, aha, you know, there's a logic to it. I could see that coming. Or if you're like me, what was the person thinking? Like, there's so many variations. How do you identify the one? Well, when you're sitting in the audience and you're as accomplished at the board, you can see who's taking who. Is the player leading you, or are you leading the player here? It seems to make sense that equipping a man with a sense of reason would then require the advantage of philosophical discourse. So a very long time ago, Freemasonry gradually came into focus as a means of organizing thinkers and doers in an experiment. Expose enough men to enlightened conversation and they will be transformed, able to make a meaningful full contribution to the world around, as well as having a balanced sense of self. No shyness in that kind of statement. While the form of masonry we know today is entirely derivative, bringing intelligent men together in simple conversation became a timeless function. Unfortunately, the scholars weren't so portable. Those who supported and encouraged questioning, leaving us with a challenge of our time. Can scholarship be injected into a system of masonry that has not been exposed? Somewhere in our background, we made a mistake. Freemasonry doesn't make a man anything but what he is. But Freemasonry as a field of study can influence outcome without pretension. One size fits all is a way to sum up why many lodges in my jurisdiction find themselves wallowing while elsewhere lodges perform with exquisite movement. Eventually, without design, a small group of men began examining and comparing outcomes. Then they began deconstructing, traveling up the Nile to its source in a way. Of course the map was accurate. Our reading of it was flawed because we lost our moral compass. If you think ideas make a man, then give us your proof. What makes you susceptible to teachings? How do we know you are capable of instruction and change? Unlike your suppositions, Freemasonry is articulate and evolving thanks to comparative thinking. There will always be lodges consumed with volume of turnover. There will always be lodges that cut above, that puts men in the company of listeners, observers that refine thinking. Emerging. Thank you. Sometimes I wonder why lodge meetings don't open up with music by Red Garland. At least it would be a start. Yeah. Today, I'm going to present to you a piece of work by a very interesting poet. And I truly wish that every man I ever met had the courage of a poet to not only examine the world along his path or her path, but to talk about it. I'm just finishing up a 13th century poem, Sing Cuckoo No. A short little piece. The cuckoo has come back and spring is there. The poet is telling it, sing now, remind me. This is the work of Robert Southey. Now, have you ever been to the Abbey? On the wall near Shakespeare's memorial is a mural monument with a bust of the poet, Robert Southey. And the inscription is quite simple. Robert Southey, born 12 August 1774, died 21 March 1843. The sculptor for that bust is Henry Weeks. Now Southey, for what it's worth, was born in Bristol and educated at Westminster School, but he was expelled for originating a magazine called The Fisherman. But went on to Oxford University, and in 1795, he was fortunate. He married a woman that he had met, Edith Fricker. And by the way, his friend Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who were very familiar with, married Edith's sister, Sarah. And after her death, he married Carolyn Bowles. He was made poet laureate in 1813. You know, you hear these references. If you're looking for the Lake poets, he's one of them. Words of all rage, you know. Nice company to be in, eh? Wordsworth and Coleridge also have memorials near Southey in the Poets' Corner at Westminster. His poetry, though, was much admired by contemporaries. Who could you imagine would be the poet's contemporaries? Walter Scott and Lord Byron, yeah. But we know today, he wrote a lot of material, my goodness. But we know it today much more for his short pieces. He wrote biographies on Nelson and Wesley and Culper. And today, he visits his grave in Crosthwaite in Cumbria. We're going to tuck into one of his pieces. So often these poets come from humble backgrounds. You know, this writer, he's the son of a linen draper. He spent much of his childhood at Bath, England, in the care of his aunt. Yeah. And as a student, he had great sympathy for the French Revolution, and he wrote a long, very well-known poem called Joan d'Arc, and published in 1796. And he first met Coleridge, who shared his views in 1794, and they wrote The Fall of Robespierre, 1794. But after leaving Oxford without a degree, so they planned to carry on Coleridge's project of a fantastocracy, our utopian agricultural community. Remember, Hamilton shared the poetry of Coleridge on the banks of the Susquehanna River in the United States. It was like if you couldn't fit into the fabric, the social fabric of Britain, you just got on a boat and headed west. You could do, well, pilgrims. Nobody's going to be intolerant over there. We'll just kill everybody that might stand in our way. Create our own patch. Call it freedom. But in 1795, he secretly married Edith Fricker. And right after that, Coleridge married his sister, Sarah. And then he went to Portugal with his uncle, who's the British chaplain, Lisbon. That's where he wrote the letters written during a short residence in Spain and Portugal. And he published them. And he studied the literature of those two countries. And he learned, he could see the mentality, thank God I'm an Englishman. Well, it's like saying, well, it's better at home. This poem, The Scholar, is a comment, an expression. Southey was had a great interest in books. Thank goodness. You explore the world through the writings of other people. And he made his own library. The Scholar was one of the shorter pieces that largely rests on today. And in the poem, the poet assumes the personality of a scholar and in that capacity gives an account of a scholar's likes and dislikes and aspirations and dreams. The entire life of the scholar is spent in books, usually by the writers of the past. And since books cannot be separated from their authors, the scholar, in essence, the company of the dead writers, or as it's put, the mighty minds of old. The classics, in which the scholar is engrossed all the time, are his true companions, and he shares his joy and sorrow with them. The scholar is naturally indebted to these books, for these books are the help him understanding the world and his cultivation of sensibility. He loves the virtues of the authors and condemns their vices. He learns a lot from them. So in this poem, he hopes that he would travel till eternity with those writers and leave his name behind, which in posterity would love to cherish, which his posterity would love to cherish. Yeah. Here. See if it works. See the pattern. You're looking over. We'll look over his shoulder together at the board he's playing. My days among the dead are past. Around me I behold wherever the casual eyes are cast, the minds old. My never failing friends are they, with whom I converse day by day. With them I take delight in weal and seek relief in woe. And while I understand and feel how much of them I owe, my cheeks have often been bedewed with tears of thoughtful gratitude. My thoughts are with the dead. With them I live in long past years. Their virtues love, their faults condemn, partake their hopes and fears. From their lessons seek and find instruction with a humble mind. My hopes are with the dead. And on my place with them will be, and I with them shall travel on through all futurity. Yet, leaving here a name, I trust that will not perish in the dust. You see the thinking. Thank you. You recognize Charlie Parker and Lester Young, didn't you? Of course. Goes without saying. Did you ever wonder if Freemasonry was created by a room full of Ponzi characters? Let me try and correct that illusion. It was created by people like you. You were there. There would always be somebody that was carrying out an idea. In every group you see that. And there would be someone else that would say, right, I'm going to pick that idea up and polish it a bit more. Maybe I'll change it a little bit so that it's more artistic, more flavorful. There's always that. We're going to at some point need to come to terms with the processes of Freemasonry. The different points and facets of the order aren't conclusions. You know, be a good man. That's not a conclusion. That's a process. Systems and processes and connections, understanding. And building layer upon layer of meaning and understanding, or the depth. That unlike North America today, particularly in the southern regions, being gregarious is much sought after. That moment in front of the camera, much, much sought after. Fame. Not so in Masonry. Your fame doesn't matter, ought not to matter. Our lodges were always troublesome. When I think about Masonry today, I don't think about some of the ridiculous things that I've heard or experienced around a lodge. That's not becoming. I want to know the nobler gestures, the things that are worth when somebody's asking why you're part of this. History helps us with this. Helps us with perspective. Let me give you a sample here. This is from Margaret Jacobs. She's, you know, she's helping us. We reached 1751. Isn't exactly burned into my brain as the time of the schism between the ancients and moderns, but that's when it was, 1751. So after allegedly those four lodges met in a bar, allegedly, well, it's a good story. Whether the lodges were equally represented, which apparently they weren't, whether some of those pubs even existed in that period of 1670, which is suspect. It's a lovely, lively story. Hey, we're going to get together. We're going to be well met, and we're going to create something. Let's go with that, shall we? Because who would want to understand? You know, it's just troublesome to get into the truth. She talks, you know, out of that period, there's a contention that's made, begging brethren to avoid all discourse that may divide you into parties. Well, how do you do that? You either do that by being quiet and letting the toff just run off at the mouth and letting the bully pretend he has an answer. But it is useful to avoid just arm's length, it's hard to decide which one is the fool. Mm-hmm. So just avoid it. Any part of it that may divide you into parties. The thinking is that you will, if you do that, you will be aware of the things that divide and you will avoid them. How does one make progress in that kind of environment? Accepting truth and speaking it. And then empathically appreciating that grasping the truth is not a matter of assuming opinion is truth. It's the process of reason. Hard enough to meet the closest one kind of religion that will give us an absolutism comfort. And avoiding the apparent coldness, the isolation of the atheist. Some men find value, find a faith, their faith in reason is well founded. Well, there are so many questions buried in that that need to be expressed and talked about, argued out. And these were the Hermetic tradition with its pantheistic and Kabbalistic associations, she says, nevertheless praised at great length in one overtly anti-clerical song. Just quickly, for truth's sake, a lord is of equal degree with a man that is owned for a mason and free. Creator on an equal footing. So much for a god of wrath. There is evidence for the emergence of country radicalism among the ancients. Now Margaret, you're not commenting about Irish-English racism, are you here? Mm-mm-mm. For 1751, someone issued an anonymous English translation of a curious work by John Tolan called Pantheisticum. Originally, it was published in Latin in 1720. Well, of course you would admit. By mid-century, continental readers of other books, associated it with Freemasonry. And they described the ritual given in the text as nothing other than Freemasonry under a different name. Tolan's book purported to describe a meeting of his Socratic brotherhood. So they're going to challenge and question. And its ritualistic invocation in nature. In other words, it's highly heretical pantheism. The English translation of 1751 from the Latin made specific reference to Freemasonry in the margin of the text. Whether issued by friend or foe, this attempt to associate Tolan's heresy with the fraternity seems too contemporaneous with the schism of the ancients to be unrelated to it. Someone like Dumont has been comfortable with Tolan's atheism as it is sprinkled throughout the pantheisticon, but not with its glorification of egalitarian fraternizing, complete with rituals. 1751, it appears that some lodges have become battlegrounds where the meaning of equality as well as the claim to possess the true constitution was being adjudicated. 8 years later, 1759, the official companion uncharacteristically remarked that the great part of mankind is not fit to be members. In the American colonies, the split between ancients and moderns led to the demise of the latter. By the 1790s in Pennsylvania, the moderns had largely disappeared. In Britain, the breach was partially healed only in the 9th century and remains to this day a subject of Masonic discussion, if not dissension. In general, the impulse of the ancients was decidedly reformist. Once freed from the discipline imposed by the Grand Lodge, ancient lodges were also experimenting in new rituals and degrees. To add an air of respectability to these innovations, they were described as Scottish. There is little or no evidence, however, for this supposed geographic origin. But the propensity of adopting these rites could signal a more general discontent. In 1759, a utopian fantasy entitled The Temple of Virtue, A Dream, employed obviously Scottish rite language to illuminate the moral message. Written by David Fordyce, this dream version takes the reader on an imaginary journey to the Temple of Virtue. Lodges employing the Scottish rite would sometimes call their meeting place just that. En route, there is a cautionary side trip into the land of vice, wherein could be found the cave of poverty, inhabited by its mistress, accompanied by a set of dismal figures, dejection, lamentation, mean-spiritedness, suspicion, dishonesty, despair. The escape from the cave of poverty is made possible through contemplation and work, taking the wayfarer along a secret path into a transparent stone with quadrangular form, its portal supported by a double row of pillars on the Doric order. Both men and women are admitted into the temple. Their virtues represented symbolically in the temple of deity, such as the god of industry and commerce, include domesticity and modesty, especially, but not exclusively for women. A willingness to protect the modest against the oppressor's wrong and scientific acumen. By the end of the treatise, the virtue celebrated is patently country in its ideological association, and the journey ends with a thinly disguised paean of praise for Pitt, his most ardent love of the got to get the politics in there. Could you see the point? Being encouraged, I would ponder that in order to value that statement, avoid anything that's going to divide you. You have to experience the pain of it. Otherwise, smugly, you'll go along and say, no dead guys are going to tell me. I have to find out for myself. I have to walk into the tree all by myself, hurt my head, not once, but over and over and over, until I get to the point of realizing that it's not the tree, it's me that's the problem. Then put the question, what am I going to do about me? Far easier. Just pretend. Archie Shepp and Horace Parlan, Trouble in Mind. Pun intended. Yeah. Thank you. I see that we've come to the end of the program for another. Of course, thank you for sitting in, being good company. I'm going to be talking about masonry in a different context next time we get together. Really, it's a matter of what we ought to do. If we subscribe to the idea that masonry has something to do with Renaissance and Enlightenment, something to do with that, is it reasonable to expect that each one of us will understand something about that connection? I'm not sure whether it's essential to our function. It is if we're going to claim any kind of historicalism, I think. How in-depth we are about that, well, of course, that depends on abilities, or whether you're distracted, or you don't subscribe, you don't believe that, well, in that whole idea about historical reference. Good for you. Good for you being an original thinker. When you sit down at the board, there are no patterns there. I tend to think it's like that old adage about putting a monkey and a typewriter in a room, locking them together and waiting until he produces a sonnet. Or, you know, not likely to happen. As you go about your business, committing those acts of random Masonic kindness, it's such a lovely idea, isn't it? Doing it anonymously, the mystery of that, being able to do that, having the self-discipline or the selfishness, that satisfaction. If you've ever been in the gym or ran a long distance, you know that feeling where you break through the wall, and it's true, you know, it happens, and it's just a wonderful experience when all those hormones are released, you know, brain chemistry changes. It still embarrasses me a bit when I think about the first time that happened. And it's lovely. You wonder, is that what we're looking for? That breakthrough, that frisson, that hormone that just punctuates what you've been able to do. By yourself, being able to do things for your own sake without praise, without the receipt for your generosity, without any of that, doing it because, my goodness, it's the right thing to do. Come back, sit in, join us. We'd love to have you. Here's proof. Thanks.